I think I just have a very few thoughts about a subject that can get us going with. Guess it has to do with the general subject is just our thoughts. Tell you, the more I have really tried to pay attention to the light of Christ in my own heart, the more I have desired, I feel a growing desire in me to be free from sin. To be honest, I really feel like I know a little bit about that verse in Romans chapter 7 where Paul says that sin has become exceedingly sinful, and I don't want to be free from sin just because the Bible says that I should be or that God wants me to be. I mean, those are good motives, but I really want to be free from sin because I want to be free from sin. I really do feel like the last 10 years, I like a growing desire in my heart for purity and that there just would never be anything in my heart and in my mind and in my thoughts and in my desires and in my actions that would have anything behind them or before them that wouldn't be the Lord. And I'm very far from coming to that place. I don't know how far, but I am far, I think. And that troubles me. And yet it also all the condemnation or the judgment that I feel for sin in me, all it does in me is create, it doesn't, I don't let it ever do anything in me except to feed the desire in me to be pure. And so the more I feel convictions and reproofs for shortcomings or failures, it seems like the more it just turns God's mill, so to speak, and makes me hungrier and hungrier for purity and to be an innocent man in this generation, something I think there are very few of in the world today. When I think of innocent, I talk about the word innocent in some of my other meetings, I think sometimes, but when I think of innocent, I think of someone that can act without anything being behind their act or speak without anything being behind their word or in front of their word. I mean, there's nothing that's causing it and there's nothing that it's aiming at that isn't perfectly pure. And the attraction that my heart feels to that is greater, I think, than it's ever been. And anyway, this it's those just to kind of maybe set the stage for what I was just gonna mention briefly this morning. It's that has drawn me to think a lot these days about thoughts. And I remember when some of you maybe have read this, but in William Schuyen, not William Sewell, the author of the history, but William Schuyen, another early friend, in the 1660s or 50s, he wrote a book that we have in our online called Meditations and Experiences. And there's a chapter at the end of that called A Treatise on Thoughts and Imaginations. And I remember reading that like 10 or 12 years ago now. And thinking that that was really neat because he talks about the importance of thoughts and imaginations. But I remember thinking that, like, let's start with actions and then we'll go to words and then we'll go to thoughts and imaginations. Kind of like that's. Let's get the big stuff like work, you know. And I think there's probably an appropriateness to that in some sense. But I've come to kind of realize that if you look at it that way, In other words, if you focus on just actions and words without focusing on thoughts or being very attentive and careful with thoughts and imaginations, then I don't think you can get very far in this journey. And nor do I think that is the right way to actually be free from actions and words by not focusing on thoughts and imaginations. In other words, I think that the better way to do it is to flip the order. And while, of course, we should abstain from, it's easier to abstain from outward actions. I understand that, and it's totally appropriate to abstain from wrong outward actions and wrong outward words. That being said, as long as you're feeding to use the word that Raphael used in a meeting yesterday, as long as you're feeding the beast on the inside with giving it freedom and thoughts and imaginations, you're never going to come to a real freedom from wrong desires, words, and actions. And so the really the battle has to be in the thoughts and imaginations. In fact, that's kind of what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10 when he says that, let's have it here. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down. He says, for though we walk in the flesh, we don't war according to the flesh. So he says there's a war that's going on. It's not in the outward man. It's not in the flesh. And the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. And don't think of, when you read that word knowledge of God, don't think of just like the scholastical or academic knowledge of God or intellectual knowledge of God. Think about knowing God, casting down everything that is against like actually knowing God, walking with God. Bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. And it seems to me that there is such a incredible need for all of us to do warfare there and to not think about our thought life or our imagination life as kind of extra credit or advanced Christianity, because I think that's a mistake. I think really there's nothing more real or more important. There's this William Law quote that I love. He says, we are, I can't quote it perfectly, but he says, we are apt to think that our thoughts and imaginations are not as important as our actions because our thoughts and imaginations don't always come out into physical expression or outward manifestation. But he says that's a great error because thoughts and imaginations are the most real and solid things that we possess in a spiritual sense, and that they are always either taking steps towards heaven or towards hell, something of that nature. They're always laying hold of that which is from heaven or that which is from hell, you could say, or advancing. Their source and their goal is always going one way or it's going the other. And so just thinking about it that way and seeing that the inward man and the things particularly that we not the thoughts that just involuntarily pop into our minds, that I don't know that we can do much about. But what is just as soon as that happens, there is something we can do something about. And just so that everyone understands, when something pops in your mind, just involuntarily presents itself to your mind, I don't think that there is sin in that, even if it's a gross thought or a blasphemous phrase or something like that. You know, that some people talk about having things just come into their mind. I don't think that it's not good that those thoughts come into our mind. And hopefully those things come into our mind less and less as we grow in the Lord. But I don't think sin, rebellion, transgression, or addiction, or anything of that nature comes from the thoughts that involuntarily pop into our mind. But it's just as soon as something comes into our mind, then there's something that we can do inwardly and invisibly that isn't seen outwardly, that then becomes the sin and the way that those thoughts or involuntary temptations from Satan, or temptations from the world, or temptations from the flesh, then become sin and actually find a place in us to grow, whether they ever have a visible outward expression that somebody else can see or not. And the thing that we can do is when a thought is presented to us, either from Satan, I think there are whisperings of Satan that present things to us, knowing our weaknesses or our propensities or our former addictions. There are whisperings of Satan that present things to us. There are things that we just see in the world, that present things to us. You're driving down the road, you see a billboard with something inappropriate on it, and boom, it's right, there's a thought. Or there's an image that comes into your mind. It wasn't something you were looking for, but there it is, or just the having the a fleshly body that is in a fallen condition can create thoughts, attractions, annoyances, angers, things like that. Just kind of boom, there they are. I think those are kind of three sources of thoughts that aren't sin yet. They're only thoughts, they're only presentations. And they come in and there they are. And someone can say, I can't control it. And you're right. Maybe and you can't control it in one sense. You can't stop it from coming into your mind. You can control it in one sense too. I mean, just kind of a side note, because if you don't unite your will to it and feed it, it will come less. It will have less power. And you will have fewer visitations of it. In that sense, you can control it. You can't control it when it's there, and you can't control it popping into your head. But the more you give place to it, you will have many more visitations of it. And again, in that sense, you can control it. But let's just say that that's not the case, and there it is. It's presented to you. There is no sin in it yet. There's no addiction in it yet. The sin and the addiction begin when the will unites to the thought, when the imagination receives the temptation and harbors it or gives it a place. Just like Paul says in Ephesians, do not give anger a place in you, or don't let the sun go down on your anger. Don't, in other words, don't let it fester in there. Because then you're giving the devil a place. What's that place? It's that's what happens. Like darkness comes knocking, and it cannot unite to you. It can't have a place in you. It can't become part of what's going on in you that day until there's a thing that happens. A thing that can become more and more noticeable, observable in your mind if you pay attention to it and you begin to deny it. And that is the uniting of our will or the uniting of our heart with the thought. I was just thinking of this thing that James Naylor says in one of his books where he talks about how, I can't remember how he says it, something about how, like, the flesh goes out fetching food, or fetching its food abroad. And if the will like unites with the desire of the flesh, then it fetches food and brings it back. It's something like that the way that he describes it. I've always liked it. It's in his treatise that's called How Sin Is Strengthened and How It Is Overcome. It's really good. And he says that the thoughts go out fetching food and trying to bring it back to the nature of sin in us. And that's another kind of another way of describing the same thing. And really, that's what James is trying to this. We talked about this verse before, but I feel like it's just kind of saying the same thing. Let no one, when he is tempted, let no one say when he is tempted, "I am tempted by God." For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. Any desires, any wrong desires that come in us as a temptation, obviously do not have God. God, it cannot, it's impossible for God to be the author of that temptation. He is not presenting evil things before man. Those things are in the world and they're in our mind because of the fall, because there are fallen creatures that are presenting those things to us, because we're in a fallen world, because we have a fallen fleshly body that it has a wrong relationship with the world, a corrupt relationship with the world. Those things are the origins of temptation. To say that God tempts man is to say, like we've talked about before, is to say that darkness streams out of the sun instead of light. There's nothing of evil, of temptation that comes from God, but there is temptation all around us. To say that God's the origin of that is to misunderstand God. And that's what he says here. Each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. So we feel desires in us. There's a wrong, as Paul says in another place, there are deceptive desires in man. All desires that aren't towards truth and righteousness are deceptive. Anything we feel in ourselves that creates a pull or an attraction in us towards something that isn't good and clean and right and righteous and innocent has some measure of deception in it. Or it wouldn't be there. That's part of what happened when man fell. He fell into an outward man, a body that has a really wrong and deceived relationship with outward things. And so man is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and he's enticed. And then he says this phrase that I always think about the same way. And again, if anyone wants to help me see it in a greater light, I'd love to hear it. But it says, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when I think of the conception of sin, so there's desire, if the baby is named sin, one of the parents is named desire, and then to have a conception, the way I see it is that we have to join with the desire. That's what Where that's there, there, here is where we are involved in bringing our desire into the conception and the birth of a sin. And it's when our heart or our will unites with that desire. And then the baby is born, and that baby is sin. And then if you let that baby grow in you, its end is death. There's no other end for that thing that is born in the heart and in the mind of man besides eternal separation from God. That's what death, that's how I see that. That's how I understand that verse. Like if you live in that thing that is born, it is going to, if you stay in it, if your will continues in it, if you don't depart from it, run away from it, ask God to destroy it and forgive it and destroy it, then the only thing that the heart of man is ever going to experience in sin is death. That is to say, the absence of life. God gives us a way both to be forgiven from sin and to be made free from sin by walking in the light. And that's what 1 John says. He says, if we walk in the light, he will both forgive our sin and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. But in order to experience both the forgiveness of sin and the cleansing from unrighteousness, we have to leave that baby behind. You have to cast out that son and its mother from the house. You see what I'm saying? That's the kind of I'm mixing a bunch of metaphors. I realize that pictures from the Old Testament of Abraham casting out the bond woman and her son from the house because he will not inherit the inheritance of the father. Well, in a very real sense, that's the business. That's our business of every day. Is casting out the bond woman and her mother and his mother, or no, the bond woman and her child. So going back to what I was saying, that all of that to me happens in our thought life, in our imaginations. Again, we're apt to think that our thoughts and our imaginations are kind of the, maybe we don't even think they matter. Maybe we think that they're the last bastion or the last stronghold. And in a sense, maybe that's true, but really, I feel like that's we can't put off the inward warfare of our thoughts until another day. That's where we have to be warring today. And how do we war? We bring all of our thoughts into a careful and constant obedience or subjection unto the life and will of Christ. In man, if those desires, those sinful desires and attractions that we feel from the world, the flesh, and the devil, if those were the only things that man felt in us, then we would be powerless to do anything about it. And it would be true. How can God punish us? Because there's no other option. What can man do besides just be a fallen, wicked creature? If that were the only thing that God had put in us or given to us, or the only condition that he left us in after we voluntarily chose it and fell into it, then there would be no punishment. There would be no ability, I think, for God to righteously punish what we couldn't help. But the whole reality of God's grace and of our salvation has to do with the fact that God has put something in us and made something else available to us that we can cling to and avoid the sin that is crouching at our door. Now, going back to, right back to Cain. Sin is crouching at your door, Cain. And its desire is to master you, but you can master it. There's a gift. There's a seed of the woman. There's a gift given to man, and especially now in the new covenant, an overcoming spirit, a powerful gift of God that our heart can cling to. That when sin presents itself as thoughts and imaginations, there is now nothing that has presented itself to us that is uncommon to man, but there is always a way out of it. There is something else that the will of man and the heart of man can unite itself to, and right there is the battleground for today. Yes, I think we should resist all actions. If we are already to the point of wanting to do an action that's evil, resist it. Yes, of course, we should bite our tongue if we're about to say something that is evil or wicked or hurtful to another person. I agree that we should war on that level too. But I don't think that the battle should only be on those two fronts. I think that those two fronts, honestly, will become less and less of where our battle is, or where we even are even feeling the battle, if our warfare is in the realm of thoughts and imaginations. And the practice, the continual practice of bringing every thought captive to the obedience of Christ is to me something that has become, again, I need to keep warring there. I have a long way to go, but it's become the most important battleground in my heart. It's become the place where I feel like the other battlegrounds are receiving their ammunition, you know? If I'm not careful with my thoughts and imaginations, my words and my actions have a lot more strength to run out ahead of me. But if I'm careful with my thoughts and imaginations, and if I'm really doing this exercise, this inward exercise of uniting my heart and my will to the seed of Christ, to the light of Christ, When a thought or temptation presents, when I have an opportunity, an invisible opportunity that nobody else can see, to unite my will to a thought, to a desire, to an imagination, to let my mind actually connect with and enjoy the sinfulness or the sinful pleasure of a thought, or the proud imagination of an imagination or a thought. You see, like you can live in your head that way. I used to do this all the time when I was a kid. I used to live in my own imagination. I used to, this is kind of embarrassing, but I used to stand in front of the mirror and let myself imagine conversations. And this is really embarrassing, actually, but I bet you guys have done it too. So don't, maybe at least some of you have. I used to stand in front of the mirror and I used to imagine myself having conversations or doing things or being involved in whatever, like imaginary relationships, imaginary proud things or whatever. And I that's maybe a more outward kind of flagrant uniting my will to thoughts and imaginations. But I remember, like in high school, like thinking I looked kind of cool and imagining conversations with people and things and whatever. And that's just one example. But my point is, there were thoughts presented, and I was so far from shutting them down and uniting my will to the spirit of Christ in my heart that I did a little role playing. I actually did a imaginary, fictitious theater, right? I don't think she'd mind, and she's not connected right now, but Eden, when she was young, she was so prone to living in her own mind and talking out loud to herself. In fact, if you go to our bathroom, there's this little thing that Jesse made recently that has a bunch of little sayings or little things that our kids wrote when they were kids. And Kaya wrote this thing. Is it okay if I talk about this? I already started, so I can delete it from the audio. But Kaya wrote this thing about, like, he was supposed to describe what it was like, what our house was like. And he said, our house is a place where you smell mom's cookies and dad's working on the computer, and my sister is talking to herself about herself, is what he said in this thing. If some of you may have read it on the bathroom wall. But yeah, Eden, that's when Eden was little, she would talk to herself about herself. And I remember I didn't understand at the time why it was at a time when I was paying attention to the corrections and the reproofs of the Lord in my heart. I always felt a need to correct her and reproof her about that, and I didn't know why. I mean, like some people, maybe you could think, oh, it's just childish play. Not really, I don't think. Not in this case. I mean, she was imagining herself to be in all kinds of roles. And like, you'd hear her in the shower giving a lecture about how to do things, like take care of chickens and stuff. I mean, that sounds like maybe innocent, but it was creating kind of a fictitious world where she was playing roles and having importance, and people were paying attention to her, and she was leading this and teaching that. And maybe in some areas it was innocent. I don't know. But I felt in my heart many times, and I ended up talking to her many times about not letting herself do that. And the reason I think it felt to me incorrect, and I think, especially as I look back upon it now, and I really don't think I totally understood why I felt that check and that reproof in my heart to have her stop creating this fictitious world, was because, first of all, because it wasn't real, and second of all, because she was the main character in all of it. And her heart and her will were being stimulated and approved and praised in ways that I thought that the Lord was going to have to end up taking her back down that road and undoing a lot of that eventually. Feeding pride, feeding self-importance, feeding identity stuff, feeding a desire to be praised. I think it's kind of the same. I guess what I'm saying is, I think it's kind of the same root. Maybe in a more innocent way than some of the other imaginations and thoughts that we can feed and we can unite to. Maybe not as grotesque, maybe not as apparently evil. But I think that in a lot of ways, things present themselves to us and we're apt to think that they're innocent when really they're feeding the nature that the Lord is trying to keep down. Yesterday, Raphael said something I liked it a lot about. He said, every one of us has in ourselves something that's kind of like a beast-like nature, a fleshy, bestial nature. And the cross of Christ ties it down. And you have to walk and to live in such a way where the cords stay on that beast and it stays tied down to the altar. And if you're not careful with how you're living and how you're acting and what you're uniting, what you are uniting to inwardly, you loosen the cords, you loosen the ropes on that beast. And then it begins to be able to wiggle, to move, to swing its horns around a little bit inside of you, to push and pull on you in ways that it can't. Now, all of us have an outward man with an outward will. Even Jesus had an outward man with an outward will. He always kept it tied down. He never let it be the governing principle. He did have an outward mind and an outward body with an outward will. And he said, I never do my own will. I never speak my own words. The things you see me do, they are God's. I won't do my own will. And what does that mean practically? Well, I think practically it means that the outward man was tied down all the time. And if it had stirrings and if it had movements and if it presented itself to Christ as thoughts and imaginations, he never united his heart to it and never let the beast have more, if it's so to speak, have I know it's maybe sounds almost sacrilegious to talk about Christ carrying around a beast, but he did carry around an outward will for sure and an outward man. And he could have acted according to that will. So whatever language you want to use to make that not sound sacrilegious, I think there's definitely truth in it. And I think there's definitely truth with us in that too. And I have found in myself that it's the inward thought life and imagination life that means so much, that has so much to do with releasing the beast, letting it free, letting it go, letting it have more liberty. And pretty soon it comes out in the things that we're seeking and the things that we're doing, the things that we're choosing, the things that we're calling innocent, but that aren't innocent, because there's something of those wrong thoughts and desires and deceptive desires in them. And it begins to have a manifestation in our outward life. And I guess all of that is just to say that it's become more and more relevant and important to me to keep all of that in its proper place, binding the sacrifice to the horns of the altar, that one verse, offering ourselves as a daily sacrifice, always putting that beast on the altar every day to be bound and to be offered up to God as that which He puts to death in us and keeps in its right spot. I guess that's it.